Hi, and welcome to our week one, 28 Days to Overcoming Food Addiction podcast. I'm Marilyn McKenna, and I am joined today by a very special guest, Heidi Seligman. Heidi is a licensed clinical therapist in private practice in the Seattle area. And one of her areas of expertise, among many, is in treating the complex issues surrounding dysfunctional eating. And so first, let me say thank you very much for agreeing to share your insights. She's been in practice for more than 20 years. And the reason I wanted to talk to Heidi about this is because, you know, certainly I have my own lifetime of experience with dysfunctional eating. But I think it's really helpful to see an objective professional position on some of the issues that so many of us are struggling with on a day-to-day basis. So thank you again. I really appreciate it. And let me start by asking you this. So I'm really fascinated by the kind of play between biology and behavior, right? So, and what I want to know, and I don't know if I'll ever get the answer to this, is there really a biology to overeating? Is there to compulsive eating? And does it run in families? Is there any sort of hereditary link? And so I guess what it comes down to is there kind of a nature versus nurture debate among professionals? What do you think?
First of all, thank you for allowing me
my pleasure.
First, thank you for the opportunity to participate in the podcast, and I think this is a great thing you're doing. I'm sure this is going to not come as a surprise to anyone, but I think the answer is sort of both.
Both, yeah.
I really do.
Yeah.
Both in my practice and in my training and in just even anecdotally, times I've experienced things, you know, with just people in my circle or whatnot, I think there's definitely an argument that either way, where people, there is a biological component. I think there's no doubt. People have their genetic wiring and how our bodies metabolize food,
and
all of that. It's very much based in biology and genetics,
right?
And we are the product of those who came before us.
Sure.
And there's no getting around that. And so if that's going to impact how we metabolize food and how quickly our bodies process and those biological functions happen, and it's inherited, then of course there's going to be some impact on issues around satiety and issues around our limbic brain that drives taste and
so the limbic brain, just to kind of to explain to if somebody isn't familiar with that, that's the part of your brain that's sort of what we think of as the primitive brain. So things that are happening at the subconscious level, so you're not even aware that those kinds of
right. So if you're particularly wired in such a way where your brain is gonna appreciate the taste and flavors of food maybe a little bit differently than someone else who just seems to not really have these cravings or not really enjoy a fine chocolate.
No, I don't mean to laugh, but I seriously was just telling this story this morning about how, like, and I wrote in the blog that came out today that my husband, like, sometimes seems like a complete alien from another planet, because I just don't understand, like, how can, you know, so what I wrote about in the blog was that this scenario that has happened on more than one occasion when Rob and I go to a restaurant, and, you know, after dinner, the waiter comes, and this is because nowadays that our kids are older, we don't have to go to restaurants with drive-thrus anymore. We go to restaurants where they actually come to your table. Anyway, but what I mean is, like, okay, so the waiter comes, and would you like to see the dessert menu? And Rob always is like, oh, you know, I'm so full, I couldn't possibly. And I look at him like, are you kidding me? Who eats dessert because they're still hungry? You eat it because it tastes good, right?
Right.
And so, you know, so he's not wired that way. He's just, I don't want to say he's indifferent to food, but he's just sort of, meh, you know, ambivalent. Like, I mean, which, you know, considering the way I cook is probably not a bad thing. But seriously, I mean, it just, it's not, it's almost never on his radar. Mm-hmm. And it can catch him completely off guard that he's even hungry.
Yeah.
Unlike me, because I feel like I'm hungry all the time. Mm-hmm. So so I think that's got to be just in the way that different ways that people are wired to kind of orient themselves around food.
I agree. And I think even to the very sort of ways our brain anatomy, for lack of a better way to describe it, is structured in terms of the intensity of taste. How, you know,
really?
Down to our taste buds and our tongues and just how all that is working. That's
wow.
Gotta be inherited. Just
yeah.
Just like our eye color and our height and our
right.
Bone density and,
yeah.
and all of that stuff. So I do feel that to a certain extent, that part has got to be somewhat
yeah.
driven by genetics.
Right.
That being said.
Yeah, I was just gonna say.
Of course.
Yes.
Beyond, you just be alive to appreciate that so
yeah.
much of behavior is learned.
Right.
And impacted by influences of parents and family of origin
mm-hmm.
and upbringing and the dynamics of,
right.
of even the emotional atmosphere of your of
right.
your early years.
Oh, hugely.
And
yeah.
how that all in very complex ways interacted
yeah.
with you personally, not you personally, but with one.
With one. It's okay. I don't take anything personally.
Each and every one of us.
Yeah.
To create certain patterns that
right.
we that are now so connected at light speed
right.
in our brains
a nanosecond
yeah that we don't even
right
we don't have even an awareness
we
of
make a huge
happening.
Leap from feeling you know an emotion or seeing some sort of cue, there's some sort of trigger
mm-hmm.
and then it leaps right over our conscious brain
yes.
and or maybe a better way to say it is it taps directly mm-hmm. into that primal brain which then we've conditioned to whether you know through our childhood environment or you know now habit as
mm-hmm.
adults
habit.
Yep. To make that leap to like oh you know whatever the next food you know I see is like gotta have it
yeah
yeah
right.
So fascinating isn't it
right and
yeah.
maybe way back at the very very beginning those needs that were truly emotional needs very quietly emerged and presented themselves, and we quickly made a connection that
mm-hmm.
oh, this seems to be meeting an emotional need, and then once that connection gets established,
mm-hmm.
Right, we're off and running.
Right,
you know?
It can actually change neural pathways,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's so much research into that.
Right.
The good news, though, is that there's also tons of research into how it's possible for
yes,
us
you
to
can, you can change it back.
Change it back, change
yes.
it differently.
Yes.
There's all kinds of very encouraging and
yeah.
really good reasons to feel very hopeful about a lot of the research into
mm-hmm.
changing the neural pathways of our brain
right.
by using...
Because I think when
yeah.
what we're so afraid of when we're locked in this battle of, you know, trying to resist, for example, a really tempting food, you're at the outset of trying to make this change, you just feel like this is, it's exhausting, right? Because it takes all your mental energy, all
mm-hmm.
your emotional resources to resist. And you're just thinking, there's no way in hell I can do this for very long. It's exhausting,
mm-hmm.
like I said, right? So so you're just, you know, you just kind of like throw your hands up and go, forget it.
It's
I can't
hopeless.
Do this. It's hopeless.
Right.
And, but the truth is that you, that every time you resist, I call it exercising my self-care muscles when I, you know, when I won't say resist temptation, but when I am aware of a trigger and then I respond differently than what I used to habitually. And so, you know, I think what I've done is actually reconditioned, rewired my brain. It's fascinating that you can do
are.
That. So yay for me.
Yeah. And really it's so rooted in the bigger idea of bringing awareness to the moment and connecting with your awareness in the of the experience you're having in that moment.
Yeah.
And so often our impulses are hiding real needs, real emotional needs. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they're not. Sometimes we're hungry because we're
absolutely
hungry.
Yeah.
But even then, connecting with awareness and real understanding of what's happening in that moment and allowing ourselves to see, yes, I actually am hungry right now. It's time to eat.
Right.
I need to nourish myself right now.
Right.
This is important. It's the bigger idea of connecting with my experience, whatever it is, so that I can really know what I'm feeling and what I'm needing.
Yeah.
Sometimes I may need food.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
I'm of the belief that, and part of the reason I structured the program the way I did is because I believe that it's in those moments of real, genuine hunger that we are extremely vulnerable in those moments. So the way the program is structured is that, you know, we keep a level of satiety so that our blood sugar stays pretty level, making us much less subject to the highs and lows, whether they're hormonal highs and lows, the emotional highs and lows, the hunger pangs, all that kind of stuff that can just wreak havoc with even the best of intentions. So anyway, that's kind of beside the point, but I don't need to talk to you about that because you already, I want to glean all the expert advice I can from you while we're doing need to talk about what I already know. So secondly, I really want to know, what do you see as the difference between people who occasionally overeat? I mean, you know, we've all been out to a special celebratory dinner, or we just came off through the holidays, right? And so occasionally, lots of folks will overeat occasionally, but it doesn't rise to the level of compulsive overeating for them. So what do you see as the difference?
I see the compulsion piece of what you're talking about is I see it as more of a pattern of learned behavior. And it's almost like in the bigger sense of ritualized behavior.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that that it is just a small part of a whole sort of negative feedback loop of engaging in a certain cycle of behaviors that leads to avoidance of certain negative feelings.
And so the
tricky feedback loop part of that is that, yes, I have this temporary reprieve from the negative feelings I was trying to avoid.
Yeah.
But I'm then assaulted by the shame.
Right.
And the sense of isolation.
Yeah.
Feeling I need to keep this secret. Feeling if anybody really knew what I was doing,
yes,
they would think less of me and maybe hate me and so I further isolate myself because it's a big secret that I'm carrying now and so on, and so then we sit there until those negative feelings emerge again and we step back into those same behaviors because that's what we've discovered works, and we do it again, and then that loop, that cycle just continues, and that is a generally, and in there is some distorted thinking, and there is lots of denial, which all sort of feeds that the first kind of initial steps of the cycle, and then we engage in the behavior, But the compulsion part, I feel, is part of that cycle. Of this loop, this sort of negative feedback loop where it just kind of keeps itself going.
Yeah.
And the thing that breaks that cycle is...
Yeah, what breaks the cycle?
I believe what breaks the cycle is opening up in the place of the isolation and the secrecy.
Yeah, yeah.
And kind of stepping out of that part and addressing the distorted thinking and the denial piece.
Right.
And with some process addictions, gambling or sexual addictions or, you know, some very serious addiction issues. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Of course, it's a lot of professional intervention and help is needed to work on those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And not to minimize the significance of disordered eating type problems.
Yeah.
Because those are very serious and actually lead to early death in many cases for people. From obesity-related problems and health issues. But I think a big part of the denial that, to some extent, can be done ourselves is the denial with ourselves about what we're doing and understanding what is it in the service of that we're doing this and bringing compassion to that.
Oh, process. That's the hardest part, is learning to... To you know, you get so angry at yourself for giving in yet again, and of course you feel like a failure. You talked about all the shame and guilt. I call those emotional napalm because it just hits you so hard after you've, you know, overindulged again. So there's the shame, the guilt, the sense of futility that I'll never be able to find my way out of this. But I think your comments that you know, that one of the ways to break the cycle is to find your way out of the isolation, because once you can find someone else who can show you what it's like to receive compassion, then you can start to give it to yourself. You know, because you I don't know, you just, I could never feel compassion towards myself until I started to realize that, oh God, this is gonna make me cry, that other people were so understanding and compassionate towards the suffering that I was in. Ugh, it makes me so emotional. Because no, I'm okay. I'll be all right. No, it's because You just feel so bad for engaging in the behavior, and to have somebody tell you, you know, that you didn't rob a bank, you didn't hurt anybody, you didn't, you know, you're just engaging in this behavior because this is the only thing you know how to do right now.
To meet your needs.
Right, but let me help you figure out, you know, what it is that's lying underneath that, and, you know, and let's walk our way through that. Right. And when somebody's willing to do that for you, you can then start to do it for yourself.
Absolutely.
And that's where real healing comes in, I think.
You're right. And even beyond that, to be able to reframe that entire situation, for lack of a better word, as a learning opportunity.
Yeah.
Because if all you're doing in that space is beating up on yourself and being really mean to yourself, you have just missed the chance to really understand what you were trying to do.
Yeah.
And what happens after we have beat up on ourselves after a while? Well, we get exhausted and we move on to something else because we have to.
And you just put it on the back burner because it's too much.
Right. And you never get to what just happened.
Right.
You never, ever get to what was I trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. What was I trying to do for myself here?
Right. Because it's actually, I mean, you said it, it's serving a need, right?
Yes.
In many ways, it's a very goal-oriented kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. It's adaptive in
the
sense
of... Adaptive. That's a better way to put it. Right. Yeah.
In the sense of, I'm trying to get my needs met here.
Right, right.
And unfortunately, the solution that I've trained myself to go to is that food is the way to do it.
Right.
Even if it's an emotional need, I'm just going to go to food every time.
Right.
It's like if I were to ask you, do you need your car to start when you leave here today?
Yeah.
You would say, duh, yeah. But the truth is, you don't need your car to start. You need to get to where you're going.
You have
looked to your car as the solution for years.
Oh my gosh, and that's fantastic.
And so what we do is we confuse need with solution.
Okay.
And so then eventually that drops out, the true need drops out. And we've just trained ourselves to go right to solution.
Right.
So that we find ourselves saying, oh, I need that brownie.
Right.
Oh, I need a coffee. No, we don't.
Yeah.
What we really need is fill in the blank.
Right, whatever the solution is.
Maybe we need some energy.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Maybe we need a pick-me-up.
Right.
Maybe we're tired. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon and our energy level just crashed.
Right.
Whatever it is. So, but we have so trained ourselves to go to solution. Solution, solution, solution.
Right.
Rather than interrupt that process.
That's amazing.
To be able to say, I'm recognizing I'm needing energy. Mm-hmm. What are some options for me right now? I could have that brownie.
Yeah.
That would work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I don't really like the consequences that are associated with the brownie.
Yeah.
I could have a coffee. That would give me the energy.
That usually works for me.
Right. But maybe the consequences are I'm going to be up all night now.
So maybe I don't want that one.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. But what I really need is some energy. Okay. Well, I could take a quick walk around the block. Okay.
Yeah.
I could stand up and do a few stretches
right
now. I mean, so it's this process of, first of all, again, connecting with our experience in the moment. I need energy.
Mm-hmm.
And often that impulse of, well, that looks good.
Mm-hmm.
That brownie looks good.
Right.
Hides the real need, which is, I need energy. I'm tired. I'm feeling tired.
Yeah.
And so it's this bringing that sort of slowing that down,
mm-hmm.
connecting with our experience
mm-hmm.
in the moment of the moment of choice.
Yeah.
Which is so hard.
Some people are much better at impulse control than others.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this really drives me to think that, well, and I don't know. I guess I can't make any kind of assumptions. But are some people, you know, do they grow up in an environment where they're taught to delayed gratification better than others of us? Or is that impulse, is that ability to control and to those impulses, is it, or willpower, I guess, is another way to put it. Is it better? Is it stronger in some people? Is it sort of like a muscle, like we can flex it and make it stronger?
I think what we all can get stronger is our ability to be aware
mm-hmm.
of ourselves
so
and
true.
What's going on with us within in each and every moment.
Right.
That isn't something that is hard to do. It's simple, but it's not easy.
Yeah.
So, I just contradicted myself.
No, I know what you mean.
What I'm saying is, it isn't always easy to do,
right.
but we all possess the capacity to do it.
Yeah.
All of us, every single one of us.
Yeah.
It's a matter of training ourselves to practice it more regularly
mm-hmm.
and consistently throughout our day, even in sort of these very incidental little moments that go by,
mm-hmm.
training ourselves to just simply be aware of what's going on with us in any given moment.
Right.
Check in with myself. What am I feeling physically? What am I feeling emotionally? And just know what's going on with us.
I think we live in a time where it's almost like a perfect storm of, you know, whether it's compulsive overeating or, you know, other kinds of, what do you want to call them, maladjusted behaviors, because distractions.
The world is full of distractions.
Right.
I mean, 100 years ago, people had all kinds of time on their hand to sit
right.
around contemplating their navel
right.
and thinking about, what do I feel right now? I mean,
right.
and I'm sure people were plenty busy just surviving too.
Right.
Let's not kid ourselves.
But that busyness also leads us to, you know, to engaging in behaviors that, you know, that our society has made really, really easy to engage in, because,
right.
especially when it comes to food, there's so much everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and so much of what's easy to grab is really unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of exacerbates the problem, or creates a problem that maybe wouldn't have existed if we didn't have those quick fixes so readily available.
Right. And not only that, our society and our culture puts this inordinate value on being distracted, and
isn't that
and
true?
Having
that
lots
is
of
so
stimulation,
true. Right?
Like the more, the better,
right?
Having, you know, 5 devices going at once,
yeah.
and you know, that's a good thing. That's right. deemed a good thing. Multitasking is deemed a good thing in, right. in our world. Right. When in reality, it's difficult to pull off really well.
Yeah.
Most people think they're great multitaskers, but they're really not doing well at any one of their right. little micro tasks that they're trying to do simultaneously. Right.
Certainly not as well as they would be if they put their focus on
right.
one
just
thing.
Just one thing yes. and really focusing there, right?
Yeah.
So it's a pretty complicated problem.
And yeah.
And even just the fact that we're all just plain old distracted by
right.
life.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's really hard to just carve out the space to just sort of pause, just hit the
yeah.
pause button, not say yes to that brownie, not say no to that brownie.
Right.
Say, wait a second.
Yeah.
Something's going on here. Something's going on with me. I'm just going to take 30 seconds
yeah.
and figure it out.
Yeah.
Am I actually hungry? Am I just responding to the visual stimuli? Am I thinking about how good it's going to taste? Is
yeah.
that what's going on? What's really going on with me right now? Am I,
one of the things that makes me think of is, you know, how I've come to redefine self-care away from, you know, what we typically think of, especially maybe as women, we think of self-care as like going to get a pedicure with our girlfriend or going to meet for lunch or coffee or whatever. And yes, those are great. That's self-care. But what I've come to, the way I've come to define self-care is that it really has to do with boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And my own ability to say no and mean it without guilt. When somebody asks me to do something, or all of a sudden, you know, their problem is my problem, or that's what they want it to be.
Mm.
And I think we're so quick to try to jump in and, you know, make other people's lives easier for them. And that's not a bad thing. But on the other hand, if you do it at the expense of your own free time, and your own agenda, then it robs you of the opportunity to invest in the time and space that you need to care for yourself. And so for me, that's how I've now come to define self-care, is that, because it's really hard to do that, you know? I mean, just this morning, my son texted me. I'm not calling him out on this because I have two sons, so nobody knows which one it is. But he texted me, can you bring me, you know, such and such, and I really need it today, it's really important. And I just said, I really can't today. I cannot, I can do it for you Saturday at such and such a time, but I can't do it today. I'm really sorry. And, his, grumbled off, in a text or something. Okay. But I would have, before, I would have just done what he wanted me to do because, I'm his mom and I kind of figured that that's my responsibility, but it really isn't. My responsibility is, to do my work and, yes, take good care of my family, but I don't need to solve every single one of their problems. And if I do, which is what I did for a really long time, it leaves me with not enough time to invest in, in the things that I need to do to take care of my own needs. And I don't think that's a really uncommon problem for women to have. I think a lot of us suffer from that. And it's much more serious than just, the kind of just say no kind of mantra that yeah. people, say that you're supposed to say when somebody asks you to do something, because it's emotionally charged. It makes you feel guilty. The hardest part of the whole self-care thing is learning to do it without feeling guilty
mm-hmm.
and knowing that you're perfectly justified in sort of standing up for your
mm-hmm.
own needs.
Right. And that's not to say that you can't have some compassion
oh, yes.
for the person you've disappointed.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Those two things are not mutually exclusive.
Right.
We can honor our own needs and at the same time have compassion for someone else's genuine disappointment.
Right.
That those, it's not that honoring my own needs means I can't see that someone else is disappointed
right.
and have some genuine empathy for that.
Right.
That so
right.
So
it doesn't mean you're being cold-hearted about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you can authentically express that compassion and genuinely say, I'm really sorry, I just can't do it today.
Right.
That doesn't, you know, that there's no rule that says, oh, because I'm honoring my needs, I'm somehow shutting off who I am as a person.
Right.
In this process.
Yeah, or becoming some sort of like self-centered kind of. Yeah, it isn't that.
And so
but I think it's sort of
important.
That black and white thinking that we get into.
Right.
Where we're either going to, you know, be... you know, this wonderful, nice person who is helpful in every way, or we're going to be, you know, a selfish so-and-so and just be concerned with our own needs.
Right.
So anyway, I, as usual, got way off track.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
The one thing I was going to add on to what you said, because I really appreciate how important that idea of is with boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, for so many people, they maybe have never had a model even of what
exactly.
that looked like.
Yes.
Of what it looked like to be able to respectfully have boundaries that where it would work for them to meet their own needs. What I was gonna say is I really see self-care as meeting your needs.
Yeah.
And that's where when you engage in this process of really understanding what you need, it is in the service of self-care.
Yeah.
Because until you meet your own needs, those needs are just going to keep coming around like a bus around the block. It's just going to keep circling around and around and around.
They're going to find a way.
They're not going to go away just because you didn't meet them.
Exactly.
They're just going to hang out there and come up again and again and again. And so by honoring those needs, you're actually taking care of yourself, which is self-care.
Yeah.
So when you can meet your needs, you are actually taking care of yourself in the truest sense of the word, whether it's a physical need or an emotional need.
Yeah.
So, and the physical need part of this is huge.
Yeah.
Because for a lot of people, their you know, their well-intentioned attempts to lose weight quickly often are not nutritionally sound.
Right.
So part of this is taking care of myself physically, being good to myself physically, and not hurting my body with compulsive eating behaviors or crash diets that not only set me up for worse weight gain later, but actually maybe hurt my body.
Yeah.
And aren't kind to myself.
That's such a big subject.
So I think this idea of meeting my needs both emotionally and physically is a big part of this.
Yeah.
But it's completely in line with what you're saying about boundaries, because if you're walking around constantly giving up yourself for others, how are you going to feel?
Right.
You're going to feel pretty resentful after a while.
Exactly.
And just not good. And so are you taking good care of yourself that way? No.
Yeah.
You're sitting there not taking care of yourself.
Right.
You're giving away your own ability to honor yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I knew this was going to happen. We didn't even get to like half of what I wanted to talk about. I knew this would happen. But fortunately, Heidi has agreed to participate in
we'll
upcoming podcasts.
Yes, exactly. Part two.
Yeah. So tune in for that. I can't thank you enough for sharing your insight and your thoughts with us. So I'm guessing that some of you probably have questions that you want to ask Heidi, and I would love to hear those myself. So so either email them to me at marilyn@marilynmckenna.com or put them on the group Facebook page, and I'll make sure that she sees those questions and we have them in front of us the next time. So for now, let me just say that I know what you're doing is really, really hard, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for the fact that you're willing to take this journey. I'm on it with you. So I'll see you next time. Until then, stay strong. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.